Welcome, friends, to the Enduring Gifts of Marvin Gaye podcast, brought to you by your 26-year listening veteran, Jessica. Join me as we celebrate these enduring gifts, the songs of Marvin Gaye. In each episode, I will share insights about the music and recount life experiences tied to it. I'm hoping to inspire you to take a first or your 500th first listen to these songs that are truly the enduring gifts of Marvin Gaye.
Hello. So we are in the month of December now, and I've been racking my brain on like the next album to cover because I'm losing track of things that were happening concurrently, combined with like where my mind is as far as like the age that I was and the next thing that I was acquiring. But so where I've decided that I'm just going to go is to the album Here My Dear. And I want to give you guys Here My Dear the way that I experienced it, because I fully experienced Here My Dear simply because it was one of the albums on the shelf. And it's amazing. So I just experienced it. I just explored it. I had no pre-knowledge of, oh, this is how it was received in 78 when it was released. And there was, you know, whatever type of review. I had no knowledge of reviews tied to this album. I just had the album. And it's such a cool vinyl experience just for that actual record opening it up. It was a double vinyl record. And actually, you know, so they kind of make a big deal about that back in those days to have a double vinyl record, like a, you know, double disc release. But to think of that medium of vinyl, and I do remember, you know, holding it, the artwork is just so freaking cool on that album. And then for it to be the size that an album is, you know, we've discussed how big those things would be. And then for it to open up and there were two records in it, it was really, really cool. It was just a cool visual experience, you know, from your very first encounter with the material. I'm looking, you know, and so this is horrible. This is the way I have to rectify this. There's no excuse for this, people. the original disc that I bought of Here My Dear. So now I'm talking to the disc, and that's what I don't really recall when I first was able to acquire the disc. But my original disc of Here My Dear, it was probably within the past 5 years here. One time, I was listening to it. It was in my car, and I ejected it to take it out, and it came out, and it cracked. I wore that shit out. I wore it out over years. I got it when I was a teenager, and it was probably about 5 years ago, so I'd had it for a long, long time, but the disc literally cracked on me. And okay, so then this is what is just so horrible. Yes, it is. It's horrific. I can't put my hands on it. So then, you know, the expanded 30 anniversary, you know, whatever year anniversary release of it came out, because it had broken. And so I was like, all right, let me fix that. And I went ahead and bought, it was a double disc version of it. And so I bought that. And now I can't find it. This is completely unacceptable. And I cannot believe that my situation, my lot, you know, has gotten to the place that I have misplaced. And I'm looking at this right now as I'm talking to you to see, like, I'm going to find it right now after I've looked in this thing
5,000 times. But I can't find it. So my original one broke, literally like cracked in half. And then I was able to replace it with the double disc. And I don't have the original release of it from the double disc. I've only got the sessions disc. I do not know what on earth happened to, another one was missing, but I know where that is. My disc, I don't know what happened to my disc. That distresses me. I can almost have a panic attack. There are very rare times, but it happens, where I can't put my hands on these two carrying cases of my discs. One time, and I probably did have a panic attack about it. I was driving my homeboy. He asked me to give him a ride into town, to go cash his check. So I drove him into town and he ran in, he cashed his check. And when he came out, he handed me $10, just gas money. And I was like, that's cool, Holmes. You know what I mean? So then I took him home. Like, that's all we had just gone to do. Go take a little ride, let him cash his check. And when I dropped him off and we were back, I could not find my primary carrying case of my discs. I couldn't. I had a panic attack. Because I thought, did it fall out when it got out of the car? And we kind of drove a little ways. It was a little ways into town. And, oh my gosh. I tore up my car and it ended up, finally, like barely where I could even reach it. It was in this awkward, weird position underneath the seat. And it just was like, but it took me a long time to find out that's where it was. So, but yeah, the thing that is one, I can't even explain to you how unacceptable it is that I cannot locate my disc of Hear My Dear. The only thing that, and I can't do this right now, Jessica, stay focused. I'm looking at my DVD collection and I'm like, did I? And I think it could be. I used to travel a lot for work and my sister bought me the best. Yeah, I love it to this day. And anytime that I get on an airplane, I take it with me. She buys the best gift. She got me a little mini portable DVD player. And so I take it with me whenever I'm on a plane. And because I would do that and I would be trying to pack late, I would get like one DVD case and I would put like multiple discs in it. And so sometimes I have opened up those discs and I find like other movies in them, or I have a feeling if I went, I have so many of them, but if I went through that, I would find Hear My Dear. So I make a mental note of that. It's in this episode. I will do that one day. But that's just not okay to me that I don't have a hard copy disc anymore of the original. That, you know, in this day and age, it does not restrict my ability to access the material, but it is just for, that's the matter. I'm like, bitch, you've been having to access your material via disc since the day before back in the day. It's not okay. So I do need to fix it. But yes.
But I don't go by the disc because I go by, I was 14. My first, like my most vivid memory, here we go. Here's the disc booklet here. My first vivid memories of the very first coming across Hear My Dear is sitting at my kitchen table after walking home up those steep hills by myself. And I used to always relish this time. Once I became a teenager, you know, moody little teenager or whatever. But I used to relish my alone time. And I pretty much still do, right? Like that blossomed at that age and it really hasn't changed. Because here's, you know, when I just say that, like the way that I would be about a relationship, even to this day, like even when I think back about
that longest term relationship that I was telling you about. Like, the thing that I just never needed to see us progressing to was living together. I really enjoy, I need my whole own place and you need your whole own place. And I don't care that I'm paying for mine and you're paying for yours. And oh, why do we both need to pay for our separate spaces? Because I need my own complete separate space. Sometimes I need a separate space away from, like, a whole entire, like, this whole entire shit. All of this is mine. And sometimes you don't need to be in it. I know I used to kind of hurt his feelings. I would just be very frank with him like that. I just tell him I don't need to see you every day. And so I very much have, I just really recall just being in hog heaven, listening to your midair, sitting at the kitchen table. I've walked home my mile, climbed up the hills. I'm in the house now. This is my time by myself. Cause, you know, I grew up with the family. Like, when you think of just being in a family environment, right? You don't really, there isn't solitude in that. There really isn't a whole lot of solitude in that. And so this was like the short 2 or 3 hours a day. And it wasn't even three, cause I would get home probably close to, I feel like it would be 4 o'clock-ish when I'd be getting home. 3:30, 4. Yeah, probably 4 o'clock because of how long that bus ride was. And, you know, my family was home by 5:36. So it wasn't a long, long amount of time per day that I had to myself. But that was like my hog heaven time. And I really just remember doing that math, that this new hard math, sitting at the table, just kind of really focusing on my math and this music playing in the background and just being very, in hog heaven. It was just like, that is my, just, it was giving me this serenity in the midst of doing my math. But, you know, I just would feel like being at that table and doing my work like that, just getting it, starting on it right away in my alone time like that so that I could really focus on it. And just, it was just ideal, ideal, ideal. And so the very first song, I will say, okay, so I'm putting on the record, right? Because by now, where I've been in the vinyls in my house. So this is kind of pre-acquiring a lot of discs, okay? I'm still really kind of reliant on these vinyls. So it's been What's Going On. It's been I Want You Vinyl. You know, there have been some discs that have blended in here, but vinyl, What's Going On, I Want You, Let's Get It On. And then, yeah, it was like, okay, this is cool. This is fun. I'm liking this dude. You know what I'm saying? Like, I am vibing on his music. What is not working? So by the time that it gets to Hear My Dear, and it was just, it was so smooth. The vinyl cover on that, it was so smooth. It had this, and he's a statue on the cover. And it was just like, oh, wow. Like, you guys, I think I would do something with this statue as a tattoo. I've always just kind of thought like that. Actually, you know what? I'm not going to divulge what I want on my tattoo, but I've always enjoyed this statue of Marvin Gaye. And I just thought kind of like, what could be better? Does somebody have that? Is somebody going to get that? Do you have the Hear My Dear Marvin Gaye statue on the front cover as your tattoo? But yeah, actually feeling that vinyl cover, it had this smoothness to it, a different feel. It was, I don't know, it was really fancy. You know, I work with kind of reproduction sometimes, and like, you know, you got your different finishes and your different weights of paper and shit. And so like, gosh, it was fancy. It was fancy. It just had this really sick, smooth finish to it. Thick. And I'm looking here through this little disc booklet, which of course has an essay. Oh, good gosh. Who wrote the essay? Yep. So I'm just continuing to go past that. Gives me lyrics here. And I don't feel like lyrics were included in the vinyl. I don't remember reading the lyrics in the vinyl. Maybe it is. I don't know. I wasn't really reading the lyrics in the vinyl. But yeah, I guess then in this little booklet, it just goes to the back cover. But I feel like it's missing the artwork because you opened this vinyl cover and then it was, you know, huge. It was 11 by 17, if not bigger. Like, I really don't know the dimensions on vinyl covers, but you know, 11 by 17, it's like, now it's laying out flat
it's, you know, the two albums. And there was artwork on the inside of that too.
And so, you know where I had to have gone? Second album. Got that playing. And it's just playing. It's long. So it had to have been playing for a while for me to come across this, because I am. Yes, this had to have been the literal day that I had put on the record and just set the needle down. And it is the last song, second to last, because it's a little reprise is the actual last song on the second album. But the last full song on the second album is Falling in Love Again. And so this is always, and it has to have been the first time, I'm literally the first time that I am hearing the music because of how vivid the recall of that is. Because I was deep into doing my homework, and I can tell you that a lot of the music, basically like right before that song, wasn't necessarily the most catching my ear and the most, I enjoy this on the same level that I've enjoyed so much other stuff from the other albums so far. They were a little different. They were, you know, very much a message. They were very specific. They were very a moment in time. You know what I mean? They're kind of those couple of songs right before Falling in Love Again are kind of just like, it's kind of like he is talking about specific people and he's name dropping and it's just like, I don't even really know what's going on. So I'm just kind of doing my homework, right? And then though, it's the opening to Falling in Love Again. And that is where I am seriously, I'm just so in hog heaven. That is where now all of a sudden the musical element of things, like that audible element of things, is just, oh, now it's like, yes, this is Marvin Gaye. And this is like a new, oh, what is this? And I'm going to tell you the reason why, just from my personal experience and my life up to that point and the music that I've been exposed to real time, like current artists up to that point. This is just mid-90s, right? Right away. I'm not trying to necessarily claim any type of copyright or anything like that. Okay. But immediately when this song started to play, Billy Joel from the early 80s. Oh, what is the song? I don't know. There is some song that, now just let me go back. I don't know the name of the song, because the only way that I ever encountered this Billy Joel song was at like 4 or 5 years old, MTV. It was a music video on MTV in these very early days of MTV. And he had some song that was really popular at the time. And it's like a 1950s themed video. And there's just all this choreography and people are just dancing, real bopping around. And there are these horns in his song, in the Billy Joel song, that, I mean, exactly the same. And so that's the reason why when Marvin's song started to play, I had heard this song before, but yet it was so much more beautiful. Let me say that loud. So much more beautiful. And I was just like, wow. I was like, that's where that other thing came from. People, it sounds exactly the same, doesn't it? So anyway, but now I was fully engrossed. I just remember being fully engrossed upon the very first time of hearing that song, a first time experience on Marvin. Never heard this song before, but it's just immediately, it's an exhale, right? It is legitimately an exhale, because it is just providing this experience that is allowing you to exhale deeply, right? Like you're just settling in, it relaxes you. It's therapeutic. It's healing. It's just, that's Marvin. And so Yeah, that's the very first time. And it literally, as I'm thinking on that, that has to have been my very literal first time experience of hearing that song, is that it just arrived to that song on the album. And truthfully, it would be such an awakening experience like that, because literally, like I say, the couple of songs right before that, I'm kind of zoned out. I'm checked out. I'm mostly just focusing on this fucking math that I have to do that I don't understand, that I'm struggling with. And it's just noise in the background, and I'm very much not really paying attention to it. And then all of a sudden, it just became this experience. So that's the first time ever hearing that song. But now, okay, if we get into Falling in Love Again, okay, I use these qualifiers on these songs, right? Is it the most beautiful? It might be, people, the vocal, the love is so great, baby. Da, 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 so love me. I mean, it's just what he's doing. And so there was no. You know, it's just, there is no tomorrow. So I mean, he is just, there's not possible to not experience Marvin's love, right? Like, he is just, it's love. It's just, well, it's falling in love again. The title is, you know, meticulously and perfectionistly placed. I want to see something here. I believe that just recently, upon, you know, general looking up of things, that I came across the fact. Yep.
What I found about the writing process of this album is that Marvin wrote it all. And so, good old little Wikipedia, it was explaining that his actual, you know, writing process, which this is actually what anybody who's doctorate level Marvin, and you don't even, I'd say doctorate level just for the depth of Marvin's material that you have to have in order to know this, but I'm not going to be dropping a bomb on you guys right now. I'm not going to be dropping a whole bunch of hard, heavy knowledge. My sister and I actually have had a conversation about this exact topic once before in the past. And it was explaining to her Marvin's kind of writing process. And you get this knowledge from session material. You will hear Marvin bringing a song to life. He begins by just kind of forming it. It's like he's a sculptor, right? Like, it just starts out kind of in a general shape, and then he defines it. He comes in and he puts in the details. That's how he arrives at the final lyrics. So he first starts, and that's what we hear in many session takes of songs that we finally have a finalized version on the original release that we ever heard that he was good with, right? But to get there was probably maybe 3 or 4 takes of the song, just to fit a word into every, you know, so that's Marvin's process. Well, my sister is huge into Hendrix. I think that really comes a lot from our dad, you know, just having a professional guitar player as our father. She's inclined towards guitar. And so Hendrix, yeah, you know what I mean? So, but she's probably got a knowledge of Hendrix like I do of Marvin. And so one time we were having this conversation, and I think I probably started it out by just explaining Marvin's process like that. But it was kind of also just to say, like, he's such a perfectionist, you know what I mean? So that finally this ultimate thing that we've received is such perfection, because it's like, Marvin, what was wrong with this or that? You know what I mean? I think, like, that's what is so enjoyable about getting access to those session takes of things, is that you just hear how beautiful the process is, how cool that process is of Marvin finally arriving at the final product.
But my sister explained that it, like, exact opposite with Hendrix is that it was take one. You know what I mean? And it's like he just kind of did it on the spot, but, and then that was it. You know, like he didn't go back through and do it multiple and multiple times. So I just remembered we had a in-depth conversation about just talking about our faves to each other one time. But so they were explaining in this little Wikipedia article, you know, that would have been knowledge to somebody that doesn't, you know Marvin deeply, that his process was just kind of starting from scratch and then just going over it over and over until, you know, every final lyric is placed. But then, so down at the very bottom of the credits here in this Wikipedia article, all songs written by Marvin Gaye except where noted. And who is, if there's any co-writing, and I'm looking here, there's 1, 2, 3 co-writing credits. He's writing with Townsend still, which is who he wrote with on Let's Get It On. There's one song, Anger, is also credited to a Delta Ashby. But the other two songs are, Townsend is in on it too. But Marvin wrote every song. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to just, please do not take away credit. You know what I'm saying? It's like the shit that I do. If I did that shit too, you know what I'm saying? Like, you did your part, I did my part, but don't take away my credit on it. You know what I'm saying? So, if you wrote on it, you wrote it. I mean, like the, so he wrote every song. Three songs had co-writers, but he wrote every song.
But I'm looking through this book right now, and I'm not really seeing writing credits per song. So, let's see. It's just telling me it was published in 78... Except Anger was published, and Everybody Needs Love, and Sparrow published by, I don't know why it's telling me this. It's just telling me about the publishing. Lyrics reproduced by kind permission. Sorry, as I'm reading here, that's slowing things down a little bit. Ritz has some little asterisks here. Asterisk. How do you say that? You know how to say the word, but that's a asterisk at the end here. Hold on. I'm reading the, and he is talking some shit. Okay, I just swear to God, people, I'm going to give you just a little example here. I am on the last page of this booklet, and it's got lyrics, like I said, and so I'm on Falling in Love Again, and it's the last song on the album with lyrics, right? So then it gave this little small print, right, paragraph about the publishing of the entire album, and then it was breaking it out, and some songs were published. But they were both saying they were published on Jobet Music. So it's like, I don't know why you're needing to say whatever. You know what I mean? And then it goes into the players. And then there's, so it's listing all of the musicians. And then there is literally a little asterisk paragraph at the bottom of that. The last thing that you see in this publication of Marvin Gaye's material. And it's got fucking Ritz. And he's talking some shit in the little asterisk. And okay, here's one thing that I am just going to say. And then I think I'll be good, and I just good and satisfied, and I won't really ever need to really address this motherfucker again, except in like little real time moments like that where I'm reading his little talking shit paragraph. But so I've mentioned this channel that's available called Kello. It's like a concert channel that you have to pay a subscription for to have access to. So anyway, one time I was doing a search on Marvin Gaye in Amazon, and it brought up a result of a little documentary on Marvin, which I just got a little free trial subscription so that I could view it one time. And
It was so, and I think, I know I've referenced this to you guys before. I was referencing it in the I Want You album episodes, talking about how they were interviewing this one guy that was playing with Marvin when he was over in Belgium. And he's one of the guys, he's a drummer that is rehearsing when Marvin is singing I Want You. And then he's the guy talking about how, you know, in order to play with Marvin, you kind of just had to be on top of your game on handling your own instrument, right? Because he's going to kind of just go with the flow in the middle of the concert, and he might change up the set list. And, you know, you got to know the songs and you just got to flow with it. So, and, you know, and that's just kind of the level you need to be at. It ain't necessarily something to bitch about, but that's just kind of how you need to come to the table, you know, contributing your part of the project. And so that documentary, there's a part of it that has been on my mind, and it's just like, I'm going to say this and it's going to fully just explain. It ain't just me. Okay. It ain't just me. So, because it maybe does seem like it's just me, and definite, trust me, it is me. I ain't going to like not own it, but it isn't just me. So they're interviewing Freddie Cousart and this guy, Odell Brown, who I realized is also in the little rehearsal footage of Marvin rehearsing I Want You, where he's singing, laying down on the couch. Okay, wait, and then let me say this. I'm going to say one thing first, and then I'll get to Odell Brown. So I'm watching that last night. I have been in my playlist on YouTube, and I got far into it the other day. And so it was into that rehearsal footage of I Want You. And I was mesmerized. I actually was doing some other things, but then I just, you know, because I'm listening to it, but I had to just stop and watch. And I was like, oh my God, I was just literally captivated. And my like head is literally cocked to the side, and I'm just sitting there just mesmerized by watching Marvin. And this is what I just want to say. You're on this podcast, you're listening to these episodes because Marvin is a fave, right? Like, he's one of your faves. And that's correct. You know what I mean? Like, that's accurate. But it's just like, you know, our fave, it is not talking shit when I use the language to you to describe him as the baddest motherfucker that there ever was, because I almost couldn't breathe when I observed that he did this, and it went past, and I was like, oh, wait, stop, back the fuck up, like 20 seconds. Did I just see what I just saw? And I think I did just see what I just saw, but I have to confirm that, and I have to rewind this really quick. And oh my God, Marvin, yes, I just saw that. You just did that, and I saw that, and that is what you just fucking did. And you are the baddest motherfucker that there. So, what do we know about Marvin? It's a Marvin growl, right? It's Marvin's growl. And like I told you, I'm not a musician, so I don't know all of the different terms or whatever, but I know, you know, they say he had a 4-octave range. And like I said, if it's limited to 4, and I don't think that it is, people, because a lot of the time when you can get your hands on, you know, the reissued, remastered 20 years later, fourth time it's been, you know, so you got all of these extra session joints, and you're hearing him a cappella, or you're like really just hearing him in the booth, you're hearing him in his headphones, so you're really just kind of, you can lightly, faintly hear the instruments in the background, but you're hearing Marvin. Marvin is doing the deepest bass. Like, I didn't even know that Marvin could sing that deep. I mean, he is down there. Now, if we're saying a 4-octave range, well, you know what is beyond that 4th? I'm sorry, that's the end of the keyboard on the piano there. That's the last keys of the piano. My man's hitting that. That's another octave, okay? So that's what I'm saying. If it's limited to 4, because I don't, like I said, the 88, is it 88 keys on the piano? Play one. He's got it. Because the bass lately that I've been hearing Marvin, I'm like, yes, of course. Okay. Don't kid yourself. All right. And That's okay. You know what I mean? It's okay. It is for real. This is legitimate. It's not exaggerating. It's not extra. It's not doing the most. It's not talking shit. It's what he did, people. And so, you know, when I don't have time and I cannot possibly be impressed, it's because I don't really give a fuck who your fave is ever. I am satisfied. I'm good. I will never, ever need more. Okay? So, when he's rehearsing I Want You, you know, there's this part in the song where he's just going off. Somehow, you know what I mean? He talks about in the, I hope you have had the opportunity to hear those four little YouTube 14, 15 minute clips of this interview that this guy did with him in 76. And he describes the process of singing like that. In those early days in Motown, being in Studio A. And he goes so far as to talk about Levi, what's his name? Because I know I always get him confused with the literal guy of the Levi jeans. Their names are similar. Is it Levi Staub? Is the guy from the Four Tops. The main singer from the Four Tops. The man can blow too, right? No disrespect. Gotta give that man his props. They, yeah. So, Marvin talks about seeing Levi being on the mic singing. And it was just the way that those Motown songs were written. And, but he was like, it would like be killing us to sing those songs. And he'd be like, for instance, Levi, you know, and they would like take a cut and he's like, you know, and you feel like you're about to just like scratch out your throat and, you know, close up your throat. You're about to, you know, he's like, they needed to get the EKG and the respirators in there to just, you know, give you some oxygen and shit. That's like how hard these fools had to be singing these Motown songs, Marvin included. And so he just said, like, you know, the way you would just have to, you know, get your throat right, you know, just to have the chops to be able to do that. And, but it was very difficult even at that. And, but he could do it, right? And there's definitely stories of like, I've told you in that episode too, I was like, you know, there's multiple times that I've heard Marvin almost coming to blows in the studio or just being there at Motown, sessions with Whitfield, you know, so that's, I heard it through Grapevine, and there's a whole actual disc called the Whitfield Sessions. And that was my first exposure to kind of just like more than the Grapevine to see like, oh, okay, these were songs recorded, you know, under Whitfield's production. But definitely that Marvin would almost come to blows with Whitfield because he would be requiring Marvin to be singing up so high. And that, you know, cause I mean, and Marvin can just go from low to high. There is in the 1976 French, is it Belgium or France, concert. I have a video of just Save the Children from that overall concert up on my channel. And I also have the whole concert there too. I don't, it's somewhere in Europe. It's Belgium. It's France. I think it's France though, because they're speaking French, as they're introducing him. And at the very end, when there's the announcer is speaking to the audience, it's definitely French being spoken. And I was listening to that whole concert, watching that whole concert. And there is a part in it. There is a song. I believe it is Inner City Blues. Crime is increasing. But he was going from like octave to octave, like tenor to alto. And I don't know, because I don't know what an alto is and I don't know what a tenor is, but they always talk about Marvin's tenor, but I don't think it's alto. But you know what I'm saying? Just like baritone to tenor and tenor to alto and alto to soprano and all of that shit. So he was going from one complete register to the next. I can't even snap as crisp as it was, because he was right here and then he was all the way over here. And that transition from the one to the other, it was like, fuck, dude. It is it's too fucking much all the time, people.
And that's who your fave should be. You know what I'm saying? Rock for your fave. Just because your fave is the baddest motherfucker of all. I mean, so crisp and clean and clear. And second 9, he was right here. And second 10, all the way, just total transition. He was cleanly, though. Didn't drag that shit. He was just hitting you right there. And the very next second, he was hitting you right there. And it was strong from both seconds, from one to the other. And I was just like, fuck, Marvin. I can't. Listen to anybody else. Who the fuck on the planet else do I have time to be listening to when I can listen to you? You know, I will not. So, okay, I can't keep a thought because too much Marvin thought is coming to my mind. But what this was in reference to is, Marvin, is practicing I Want You in Belgium. And he's got his little, like, 4-piece band. And there's the dude on the drums that I've told you just gave his little commentary. There's this dude on the bass. There's Gordon Banks on the guitar. There's some little dude on the keyboards, and then there's Odell Brown. Odell Brown's kind of playing with some, and Odell Brown, he's in this Kello documentary, and he just explains, like, they had started to get some new instruments in, and he was playing around with them. Oh, so he's kind of doing some kind of a synthesizer thing. You know, he's just kind of making things vibe, you know what I mean? Vibrate. He's synthesizing the thing. And that's what Odell Brown said. He was like, and him and Marvin would kind of fight about the instruments, you know, because it would be like new instruments that were coming in and they would just be playing around with them. But he would maybe want to get his hands on it first and Marvin would kind of be looking at it. So it's the part of the song where Marvin is screaming, you know, somehow there's just, that's the Marvin growl, right? That's the Marvin growl. And that's power. Can you hit that? Do you hit that? You come on now. I'm sorry. You don't. Bless your heart. You don't, but you would, you know, nice try. But this is why I'm just talking about how our man is the baddest motherfucker that there ever was. Because, okay, I'm not talking shit, but I just said you can't hit that, right? You don't hit it like that. You don't have the growl. You don't have all of that. Okay. And when Marvin is rehearsing this song and he gets to that part of the song, it was at that part of the song where my baby decided to lay further back down. Like, he's hitting that for us, which you can't hit standing up, right? And what he's doing is he's laying down. He's just getting all the way flat. He's like, he comes back down onto his elbow, but he's kind of just getting a little bit lower. Watch it. Because I saw that. I heard it, and I wasn't completely paying attention to what I was looking at. But then I was like, stop, shut the f-. I have to rewind. I have to see. Now I need to pay attention because I'm going to look real closely at that. And yeah, and he is laying down. Oh, this fucking thing. It just turned itself off. Hold on. Let me see how far I got and if I need to re-record.
Okay, good. It didn't stop recording.
I think I just needed to make some adjustments on my settings so that I don't see this thing going away so quickly. So anyway, yeah, he's laying down as he's hitting that because he can do that. He can give you all of that flat in a horizontal position. Don't try that. Don't try that at home. So Odell Brown, like I tell you, he's playing around in that rehearsal session on the synthesizers. So this is at the time of Sexual Healing, right? This is, they are going to do a short little European tour. They hit a few little locations there in Europe and they're just kind of covering his greatest hits. We have access to this. This is amazing. It's on the YouTube channel. I think most of you guys are probably subscribed. I'm up to 28 subscribers now. I just on the YouTube channel, just to give you a heads up, I've had access to, you know, my full graphic design programming. And so it's allowed me to kind of just put in some of the touches that I wasn't able to kind of like access my full program for a little while, and now I do have access to it. So it's allowed me to put some tweaks on my graphics that I normally would put on there. So I'm prouder of the way that my stuff is looking. And then I've just been going through. I haven't really been as present. I haven't been uploading as much new material lately because I've been trying to kind of clean up the stuff that I already have on there just to make it a little bit more visually appealing and a little bit more visually clear right off the bat what my content is, because I was noticing that my thumbnails were just not as clean and to the point as they could be. So I've been going through and what doesn't take me too much time to have to, you know, improve, I've been improving. So that's been taking me some time. And I've been spending my time on that. But all of that is to say that on the YouTube channel, I came across in the past month or so, a concert, audio, full concert though, from that little tour that he was doing in Europe at the time. It's one of the European countries that he gave a concert at. And so you just have the set list and just like the music that he was performing at that time. And it's a good set list. I like it. He's doing Hear My Dear. He's doing songs off of Hear My Dear. He's giving you Funky Space Reincarnation. I'm trying to think if he does anything else off of that album. I think he kind of just gives us Funky Space Reincarnation. But he gives us After the Dance. I don't know if I heard him do I Want You, though. Like, I really do say, people, I think the only time I ever heard Marvin sing I Want You in concert was in that Belgium concert. But anyway, they did a little stint there, and this guy that was playing the drums in the Kello documentary, he pointed that out. He was like, they had gotten hired to come over there to do that, and the tour didn't last as very long or as long as maybe he thought it was going to. And then he was like, and just that quick, we were kind of coming back to America, but Marvin stayed behind. And Odell Brown is interviewed in this documentary too, you know, this many years later. It's much past Marvin's death. But like I said, this was during the time that Marvin is both doing that tour of his older material, right? Or his just material up to that point. But then he's also just starting to decide to do the sexual healing project. And so Odell Brown is given some co-writing credit on that album, specifically the song Sexual Healing. And he's just explaining, again, like I said, he was excited for these new instruments that were coming over because they had now signed with Columbia Records. CBS. Is it CBS Columbia? I don't know if that's the same thing. But, you know, Larkin Arnold. And they're writing music. They're just playing around and they're coming up with new music and stuff. And so Odell Brown is credited as the co-writer on Sexual Healing. Now, I made this point before, in some point past, when I was saying in the biography, the book biography, it discusses the song Sexual Healing, and it says that it, and I, once I saw this documentary, I knew that's what I had read in the book without revisiting the book. It said that the song Sexual Healing in the biography book by this clown, is written by Marvin Gaye and Odell Brown. And Odell Brown confirms the same on, and I don't even really know if he, I'll tell you what he says. Again, paraphrasing, because I saw this, like I said, about a month or two back. But Odell Brown, hold on, what I'm going to first tell you is what Freddie Cousart says, right? Because Freddie is the one that brings Marvin over to Belgium and is basically for a time kind of became his manager, just was kind of helping him with all aspects of, you know, he established that tour, he set him up on that tour, and he was just kind of overseeing things for Marvin, helping him out, you know what I mean? And I really just kind of get the impression that Freddie had a really good heart and just really cared about Marvin. I mean, that's what you hear from his widow, I don't remember exactly where I've seen his widow talking, but there's some other documentary. It might be Remember Marvin Gaye by Richard Olivier, but, she just said, like, she could tell
like they could tell that Marvin was just so happy to be around people that he could tell really cared for them. Like I told you, he was eating better once he got over there. And so I guess like they had a little hotel and this lady was the cook at the hotel, and but she was a good cook and like a home cook. And there's, it's a picture, you may have seen it, it's on my Pinterest page. Marvin's eating some fried chicken, you know, he's just got some good homemade down home food and he's just tearing it up, you know what I mean? And she was saying like he was always just wanting her to cook him some kind of a homemade meal like that. So, you know, and he appreciated the love, just that kind of family feeling, right? You've got pictures of him there. He's hugging his little boy and the Freddie's children too. So, you know, he was doing good there. And so, like I say, my take, you just can kind of quickly get some takes on things, takes on people, right? Like the exposure that I've had to Freddie Cousart, it just seemed like he was genuinely, you know, trying to help Marvin out. So they, in this Kello documentary, Freddie's still alive and they're having a chance to talk to him. And they're talking about when Ritz comes over there to Belgium, because over time, right, he'd been meeting with Marvin and just kind of interviewing him for a supposed biography or whatever. I think like they have a lot of hiatuses in between their times that they're able to, you know, just really be focused on it and meeting up to discuss an interview. So he comes over to Belgium. You should watch this. This is very telling. Like, you don't have to rely on me paraphrasing, but like I am telling you, it's not just me, but you can, if you can get your hands on this documentary, you'll see what I'm talking about. So Cousart is explaining that he, you know, they get contacted that Ritz is in town and he wants to meet up with Marvin or whatever. And Cousart lets Marvin know that. It's supposedly like Cousart is the one that lets Marvin know that. And according to Cousart, Marvin says, oh, I don't have time to talk to him. I don't, you know, no. So Cousart goes down to the train station or wherever this fool's just, you know, come into town. And he tries to, you know, basically just say, hey, you know, now's not the best time for Marvin. He doesn't really have time to meet him or whatever. And Ritz is in this thing too. And he's like, so now you hear Ritz is taken. I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, oh, that's all right. You know, that's fine if now doesn't work for him. You don't even really have to tell me where he's at or anything. He's like, I'm just going to hang around here because how hard is it going to be for me to find a 6-foot tall black man here in this small town in Belgium? Like, eventually I'm going to come across him. So that's cool. If he doesn't want to talk to me now, like, I'm going to basically. So there was that, and then, but Ritz was offering his little color on, you know, what his impressions of Cousart, and so there was kind of just about that, and then all along, they just kind of chop into people. Whenever they're talking to people, they're talking to that one person, right? It's not, like, necessarily a group. I feel like one time we get a shot of Anna and Marvin III and then Jan and her two babies. But other than those combined people, it was always just singular people being interviewed. So now, you know, and Odell Brown's in a totally different location, you know, so then they come back over at one time to Odell Brown, and they're just talking about how sexual healing, right, and writing on the album. And Odell Brown just says, right, because I don't want to be vague. So it's that, you know, supposedly Ritz wrote the song, right? But he, you know, there's different versions of Ritz's take on that, but it's gotten down to an article that I came across that was supposedly interviewing Ritz, and Ritz, I told you what Ritz, oh, I just kind of, you know, I thought up, like, how would Marvin say it? And, you know, what kind of words would Marvin use? And, you know, how would it sound like if it was coming from Marvin Gaye? And that's how I wrote it. And I'm paraphrasing again. But so that's the last take that I've kind of seen on Ritz's side of that story. But, and like I said, that right there, that little, and it's pretty recent. That was a very pretty recent interview from Ritz. But back to this book biography, when it got to the topic of the song Sexual Healing, it's credited as having been written by Marvin Gaye and Odell Brown in that book. And then
we chop over to Odell Brown in the documentary. And this is about all he had to say. He's like, I didn't even know who David Ritz was. Like, I didn't know who that was. But yet this motherfucker wrote the song that also, I guess, Odell Brown gets co-writing credit on, according to Ritz. And Odell Brown didn't even know who the fuck Ritz was. So, when I did the Turn On Some Music episode, I had to get into my package of that album. And again, it's like, I don't know what the fuck this motherfucker has, like, negotiated for himself, or, like, why he is so heavily relied upon, like I said, to be the, you know, supposed, you know, go-to expert on Marvin Gaye. Okay, fine, fuck, yes, he's got a book that he wrote on Marvin Gaye. But here's one other thing that I will just add in. It was kind of within the time frame that I came across that little interview that he gave, captioning his writing experience on the song Sexual Healing. Something totally separate, but it was about how more recently-ish, I want to say in the 2000s, he also wrote a biography with, kind of co-wrote, semi-autobiography type of situation for Aretha Franklin. And a version of the book got released as that. And then I feel like it's been since she passed away that I was reading this, and that maybe he was spouting off at the mouth, talking about how he didn't really like the version that they released because it didn't give, basically, you know what I mean? It didn't give him enough of the tea. And so that maybe he was thinking about going back through and just adding more stuff into it that, you know, she had not wanted to be included. Trust me, when I say this now is enough, I am just conveying to you that I am completely convicted of, you know, my take on this man. And it is not a positive one. But again, too, when I had to get into my package of Sexual Healing, which I explained the only time that I have purchased that album was when I was a sophomore in college. It had been released again in 98 and must have been about a 25th anniversary, right, from when it was released. And he's writing throughout the whole thing. And I think it kind of gets to a little asterisk again at the very, you know, like one of the last fucking things you're seeing inside of the liner notes. And bothered to be conveyed like this. And let me, you know what? I don't know that I've fully made this point enough to you guys yet. But I'm going to circle back to kind of how I got off onto this whole tangent, is that I was looking through this fucking Hear My Dear booklet. Because I was trying to see writing credits, right? And that's what I told you. And then I got off on this whole fucking tangent about this motherfucker. Because when I was trying to read through this book, I came to this final little fucking asterisk that is talking shit. And it is Ritz. And just, if you have... This is not like the 40th anniversary. This is probably like the first time that Hear My Dear was released on disc. So it's like that issue of the disc. And... It literally, I'm telling you, you go to the very last page on the inside and there's this little, read that and tell me what it's not doing. It's talking shit, okay? The Sexual Healing booklet, same little deal. Little tiny note, little post note, right? Little postscript note saying that, and like this, like I said, I don't know if I've fully made this. I know, let me clarify that. I know I have not fully made my point to you guys yet, just via albums that I have yet to cover of Marvin Gaye. But I know that I have covered it in my very first episode of this podcast where I'm going off on Rockin' After Midnight and I'm saying how Marvin was in Belgium and he was rejuvenating himself and he is showing the fuck off on these songs. And it's because, do you think he's letting you know, do you think I don't have my hand on every single element of my music and that I haven't been doing this shit for about 25 years up to this point in time? So trust and believe that by the Sexual Healing album, Marvin Gaye is fully accomplished and capable of. And what we learned from Marvin Gaye's own words from this 1976 radio interview, where he's explaining that he is one of the most prolific songwriters that you will ever come across. His fucking royalty checks, his contracting with Motown does not allow for him to receive enough financial reward from releasing the thousands of his songs that he has within him. But don't twist that in your mind to think that he's not fully and 100% capable of writing songs, coming up with string arrangements, totally, you know, controlling what the final flow of all of the instrumentation on his project sounded like, that you and I are able to listen to. That, yes, I don't give a fuck, I might not be able to pick up the cello and play that, but you will play it until it sounds like what it sounds like in my head. Do you know what I'm saying? So, and definitely Bisexual Healing, just simply because that's the last album that we're blessed to get from Marvin. He is fully capable of doing an entire project from start to finish, executive producing that shit, writing all of that shit, and overseeing all of the instrumentation of that shit, coming up with all of the lyrics for that shit, okay? He could do that, and he was there, and he was at that place. So do me a favor, if you have access to that 25th anniversary edition of Sexual Healing, look in the book. Pay attention to this little note that is unnecessarily put in there. And this is where I go back to the point I was just making a few minutes back, where it's like, I don't know why the fuck, I don't know what this fucker had negotiated for himself, that for some fucking reason, every issue coming out of Motown of a release of a Marvin Gaye fucking this is the one up in the fucking liner. He's writing the essays. Like, I just don't know why he had the lock on that for so many things. But the little asterisk in there says all songs written by Marvin Gaye. Don't let me talk shit to you about this. Let me get it so I can tell you, because it's right here. Okay, my babies, I just had to go get my little booklet here. Here we go. I'm quoting. Everything I've just expressed to you up to this point, here's a quote. All songs written by Marvin Gaye, comma, except, quotation, Sexual Healing, quotation, written by Marvin Gaye, Odell Brown, and David Ritz. And, quotation, My Love Is Waiting, quotation, written by Gordon Banks. And there are 14 songs. Well, 13 songs on the album, which is this double disc, so it's the sessions as well. But that's 13 songs worth of material that, wow, Marvin was able to write all of that shit. Except, right, get your fucking life. So this is it, because I just don't have anything else that I want to give time to on that person. But that's why I just say, like, I'm fully convicted of
my takes on this. And it pisses me the fuck off. Do you know what I'm saying? And I know that I have made that perfectly clear. But it's just like what I'm telling you, like our fave, right? Like, and he's the baddest motherfucker that there ever was. So when it comes down to making such a big fucking litigious legal deal about this bullshit. And then I don't know, you do that and you go that far and you make it a thing, an ugly thing. But then now too, after that, you're the motherfucker that I have to see writing for it. I am telling you people, as I've gone through, I maybe have, and I, you know, my Marvin Gaye collection, I think I've seen two. And I'm going to tell you where it was. It's the Marvin Gaye and Tammy complete duets. I was refreshed to see that wasn't. Actually, let me count this. There was a release of What's Going On. That included some other articles. And there has been the 40th anniversary of Trouble Man. That were other people. I wish somebody that had some say had an issue with it. Like I do, because this motherfucker would not, you would not have to hear from him again, okay? You would not. But I just, like I said, if I see that, that's what, so like, yeah, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of his shit in here. I ain't reading on that. I don't need to know nothing that that says. Then it comes into lyrics. So, you know what I mean? It's just like, I don't yet have my copy of the live What's Going On, like the actual disc, but it's on Spotify. Let me just talk about that too. It's on Spotify. Oh my God. I listened to that yesterday. Was it just yesterday? I was at work yesterday. And I was listening to that, do that. Because there it is. It was already available. We've already had access to it. But, oh, do it on Spotify if you don't have the disc yet. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I just am hesitant. But I am going to get it because supposedly they have some, you know, artwork in there. Some pictures. But the sound quality on that. I was hearing background singers that I barely faintly could hear in the version I've had so far. But you know what I also can hear a lot more clearly is how they fuck up on Marvin's song so much. Oh my gosh. And I don't want to hear, you know, shit about how Marvin did not rehearse for that concert because I have two pictures. You know what? I'm going to make a board for this episode and I will put those two pictures in that board. I have two pictures of Marvin rehearsing for this concert. Two separate places, locations. He's wearing totally different clothes. My baby was practicing for this concert beforehand. It's not a situation of he just showed up. You know what I mean? And now that they have remastered it, you can just, it's crystal clear. The way they rush him, the way he can't even sing his, he's trying to sing and he's it's like they make him almost stutter. My poor. So, okay. So this episode is, you know what this episode really has been for me? It is the name of the song, Falling in Love. Like, have I just not even been able to have one thought because I have so many Marvin thoughts? It's like, I am so in love with Marvin Gaye. You know what I mean? I don't know how many times I've told you that. Of course, you know, I didn't know him as a person. So he was not my man. Do you know what I'm saying? But like what you have access to, and there's no again about it. You know what I mean? Like there's no again that's needed. Okay. So now from there, let's discuss the content of the song. Okay, because that's the name of this episode. But yeah, Falling in Love Again. You know, it's just, I would not say there is a word in this song that is not just a story of love. And it is definitely, you know, this actually, to start on this album with this song, is a perfection segue from our last episode, which was Just to Keep You Satisfied, right? Which is the total heartbreaking,
just real end to something. And then you do, once you've gone through something like that, to ever again in life find yourself falling in love again, I don't even think you're prepared for that. You know what I mean? All we can both try and do is be happy. And how I personally, this is my own personal thing. I'm not trying to put that on you, but like I just said, how I take that as kind of being cold. And the only way that he could be saying that at the end of that song, after the whole fucking message of that song and how he's saying, oh, well, all we can both try and do is try to be happy, is because you don't even have a mindset of that thought process coming out of that type of a relationship at that final ending of that relationship. Just for me personally, it was years. It was just like, I would say the first year I was just a bear of a human being adjusting to my circumstances because I apologize in that previous episode, this little device that I'm trying to record on was acting the fuck up on me and it kept, I would be thinking it was recording and it would chop off. So one thing that I said, but I didn't bother to correct it, but I will say it right here, is that for myself, for my personal self, when that relationship of mine came to an end, it was very jarring for me because I had been in it to win it. I could have seen myself with that person 20 years down the line. There elements of that relationship that were intact like that, to this day, they would have still been intact like that. Let me put it like this. The things that worked about that relationship for me would have always worked. Today, they would still be working like that. So when you're in a situation like that with somebody where you don't ever foresee an end to things that work, if it comes to a complete end, and just from the point of view of a woman, and especially the point of view of a woman, the age that I was, which was really kind of the time where things can kind of tend through a relationship like that up to that point, they can kind of go one of two ways, right? They can end or they can go to the next. They can just kind of get solidified and they just, you know, now we are doing this for the next 20 years or whatever. And again, though, like I said, this kind of goes back to the very beginning. And I've already told you guys this in my very first episode. I have never been a proponent of marriage. It's not the example, real life example, that was my reality. that's not based on the things that I was able to see. My takeaway was that marriage is not the be all end all. So I didn't ever want to get married. I didn't need a whole lot to change in that situation. You know what I'm saying? Like, I needed my own place. He needed to have his own place. We didn't ever really need that to change. I'm so serious. And I did not need to be married to him. Like, legit. We could have Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell that shit. You know, that's all that I needed. You know what I mean? I'm not that chick. I'm just not that chick, dude. So, despite that, you know what I mean? It's like you were just seeing yourself in something forever and that doesn't come to pass. It was very jarring for me. And I was kind of right at this age where it's like just status quo to see a young lady, because I was young, you know, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're just single? You know what I mean? Because it's like you're kind of in your prime of young beauty. That's all I'm going to say. Prime of young beauty. Because I look at myself now at 40. Girls, ladies, men, everyone. I'm holding up wonderfully. You know what I mean? It's like I am still just satisfied with what there is to see. You know, and that's not everything. But it's like 40 is not anything to worry about. You know, I'm still satisfied with what I see. So, but at that time, you're at the prime of your young beauty. You know what I mean? It's a different thing. It's a very unconscious thing. You don't even have an ability to fully appreciate it, and you're not taking care of it the way that you are by the time that you're 40. You know, by the time that you're 40, you're just about, I think it's like tapping into a new place, because yes, there are some changes, But we, even with those changes, it's like, damn, it's still looking good. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, this is really fucking kind of cool. You know what I mean? Because it's like, oh, yeah. That's the, yes, that young man sure was trying to holler at me. But when you're at that younger age and you kind of are unconscious, you don't know what you still have to look forward to by 40, right? It's a loss. It's a loss. I think that's the best way to state it. It's like, it's a jarring loss. And it just, I became a woman then that had to start experiencing life in a way that I had not ever prepared to experience it. Single. You know what I mean? Like, if you are a woman who has been in a long-term relationship and you kind of had that expectation, like you were just really going to do a long-term relationship and you were just about relationship, you know what I mean? But you were with that person though. You didn't need to do relationships, plural. You were in the relationship that you were, you know, content to be in. And when that comes to an end, all of a sudden, and like I said, it was my highest priority. So my life was flipped upside down, and all of a sudden, I was a single woman. There's some movie from the 70s or 80s or whatever, and they made it. It's, I think it's just called Single Woman, Single Female, something like that. But it was like from the 70s or 80s because it just, that in itself was such a thing. I feel like they said the premise of it was that. That was an identifier. It was like an application that a woman was filling out, kind of like, I think, you know, probably post a divorce or whatever, but it was like a way to label yourself. And one of the options was a single woman. And it was just like a stigma tied to it, right? Like, and I definitely think at the time that this happened to me, I think that there was more of a stigma. I don't know that there's so much of a stigma about it nowadays to be a woman my age and single and never married and never had kids. But when that happened to me, that now all of a sudden I was like completely single and just like unattached. It was, you just felt like, I just felt like this stigmatized piece of shit. You know what I mean? It was just like, what the fuck is happening in my life now? You know what I mean? Like, what the fuck is my life now? Because this is not what my plan had been. This is not what I had set out to be. And I, what did get caught in my last episode was something like how I said, and I'm not judging. Because what I meant by that is that if you happen to be a woman that is spared that kind of a jarring experience, so your life just kind of goes a little bit more smoothly, a little bit more according to plan, right? And you kind of just manage to be with that person and then the thing just kind of solidifies and that's just what it is, then you don't experience ever having a life alternate to that. And I don't have any judgment for anybody like that because I could have been that, you know what I mean? But it's something different. It's something else. I think I'm not going to get religious or anything, and I don't even know religion at all. That's not what my thing is based on. My faith is not based on religion, but I'm just going to briefly tell you this a little bit. So kind of because of that, I wasn't raised up in religion, but I was raised up in spirituality. I was raised up in believing in God, and I was even just raised up in believing in Christ. But it was just left at that, you know, it was just kind of as basic as that. So it was a very personal experience, right? It wasn't about a church experience. It was about a very personal relationship. And I just go by calling him Christ. And, you know, I have a very individual knowledge of him in my life, just the way I have this very individual knowledge of Marvin, that I shared that one very little individual personal experience with you guys. And I was like, and I don't care if it's weird to you, like I've had experiences like that throughout my life, just very poignant, very personalized to me experiences involving Marvin's music and special little things like that. Exact same way, Christ. So, but I didn't have religion and I didn't know the Bible. But I, and it's like, but damn, that's, I want to know it though. You know what I mean? But I'm just such an independent person. I wanted to absorb it by, for me, just me. You know what I mean? That makes sense, right? So I got this,
audio, a Go Bible. It's a Go Bible. And I got the NIV version because I had gotten one for my stepmom and I got her the King James and it was a little bit too hard. It was a little bit too hard to understand. So then a couple years later, because they didn't have anything other than that at the time. So a couple years later, then they had this NIV version and I got that for myself. And I was just like, you know what? I'm doing, like I said, I'm doing this myself. And so I got into it and they had this little program within it where it was like, oh, go through the Bible in a year. And I was like, okay, let's do that. So I started with that. But the way that it was taking you is it would play you something here. And then the next thing, it plays from something from here. And then it would play you from something from here. Well, fuck, if I'm going to go about it like this, and I don't know what the fuck you're telling me, then I might as well just go to church right now. You know what I mean? I might as well just start going to church right now, never having grown up in church. I don't know the Bible. And then you just go to a church and they're like, today's, you know, message is off of this right here. And then we're going to just a little bit read this. And then I'm going to tell you more of a, it's like, that doesn't work for me because I'm not learning the Bible. You know, I want to learn the Bible. I just want to learn the Bible. So when I was seeing how that little doing it in a year was going to skip me all through it. And I didn't, no, that did not work for me. So I was like, fuck this. I shouldn't even say that right now as I'm trying to tell you about the Bible. So, and I'm going to make sure I don't say that again. I was like, I'm just going to start at the beginning. And I'm going to go from the very beginning to the very end. And that's that. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of have a feeling that if I do that, that would probably be correct. And so I did that, and it probably took me about a year. And it was very cool, though, but it was very my own experience. It was not rushed. It was at my own pace, and I just went from literal start to the literal finish, just listening to it. And that was the best experience for me, too. I didn't want to have to read it. Like I told you, I can't read. I burned away my brain cells. So it was just easier for me to hear it. And then in just common day language. And it was very amazing. But, and I'm just going to, this is what I'm saying. So I don't know religion and I don't know the whole thing. And I couldn't spout things off to you. But I do remember the sequential story. And it went in a sequence. When I started from the start and I went all the way to the finish, it went in a very sequential sequence. There is a purpose for the flow. You know what I mean? And so I'm listening and I'm listening and I'm listening, right? Like I've been listening for probably 7 months, you know, and then it was into Corinthians. And I first or second, I know there's first and second Corinthians, but there was at some part in Corinthians when it was talking about being single. That I would say that thing from the Bible, the most is the thing that sticks out to me. And so I don't have it in front of me and I'm not trying to teach you about religion and I'm not trying to preach to you, but for myself personally, the thing that stuck out to me the most was that it was just talking about being single and that it's okay to be single and that almost maybe sometimes for some people, it might be spiritually preferred for you to be single because in that way, I can get through to you the most. And I know. I've already told you. It was in one episode. I was like, oh, because when I do that. And like, I wouldn't be able to be doing this podcast if I had a man right now because I fully do my man. You know what I mean? And that takes up all of my time and energy. And yes, very much so. Therefore, I'm not as fully available. You know what I mean? But as I have been single, as I had to embark out on this single life, which is a great life, I can see that I am more available for God. And that is a needed thing for myself going through this life. So I'm good. I'm still good. But sure. You know what? Anyway, there did come a time in life where it was like legit. You just experienced yourself falling in love again. And I think like definitely coming out of an experience that was as intense and deep and long and hard as one could be, you know, and you get past that. And it's time. I'm, you know, me. I go hard. So it takes me a hard, long time to get past it. But then just
that happened. Like, even for me, that happened. And it is so beautiful. It is, I think that is like almost the most beautiful kind of love. I think that relationship right there, that relationship, fresh and new outside of one that was, you know, maybe the most. And then you went through that, and I did not have a capacity to think that there would ever be a falling in love again time in my life. And there just has been, you know? And it is such kind of like an accomplishment and an achievement to get to that place again, you know, because it's so beautiful, right? It's just such a blessed place and space to be in. So, you know, I'm looking at these lyrics here, and like I said, it's just, and the way that he opens it up, right? It's like, oh, that's the reason why I can hear you, Martin. I can hear you, because just from the way that you start out, the words that you're putting together here, it's still, yeah. I'm reading. I'm sorry. Because I'm not. Let me just see if there's something that I have to say to you. Well, it's what I already just kind of was singing because in the beginning there, because that's just such the beautiful part. You know what? I think it's right here. When somebody real comes in, you know what I mean? When somebody real and someone you feel comes in. Yeah, but it's that part. I'm looking at the lyrics. It's the last paragraph of lyrics. And that's the part where his singing on this song is just like, oh my God. Is it the most beautiful? Is it the most beautiful? We've had the most delicate. We've had the most this and the most that. The most unique, right? We've had the most unique. We've had the most delicate. We've had the most gentle. I think this might be the most beautiful for me. Maybe. There are so many beautifuls. But it's just when it's to this. The love so great, baby. There is no more Marvin Heaven than that. Except for those, it's just like, it's so, 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 so beautiful. I'm so hopeful, you know what I mean? And yeah, you can get there. It happens. It really does. And then what I think, like, once you get there too, it's just like, okay, you know, this life is just full of this. It's just full of this. And who knows, you know, how long each time lasts, but, you know, definitely. And so I will say this, you know what I mean? Like, the last one that I had was quite not healthy and not good. Just on the part of the other part, like, just what that other person was not healthy and not good. And, but honestly, even that, like, I was thinking of this just the other day, someday this week, I was like, wow, you know what I mean? Even that was very much for the purpose of, it turned me on though, too. Like I said, it's like, sometimes you have to have an experience that just, something's got to give, you know what I mean? And, you are the common denominator in what you attract to yourself, because nobody wants to be the victim, right? And if society, you know, is going to kind of shun you and not even, you know, discredit you if that's your story and that's kind of the way you present your story, well, then you don't want to be discredited and you don't want to be shunned. So if not being a victim is what you know you have to not be, then you just have to accept you are the common denominator in what comes into your life. And if that's the case, though, and if something has to give, then okay, let's figure out how to do that, you know? And that is what that last thing kind of was. It was like, okay, something's got to give. And like I said, I think at least the place that I'm to is that it may still be the story of me anyway. But I am at least tuned into that. And I at least know, you know,
unfortunately, what those kind of tendency attraction things tend to be. But, and if I, even though it may be the story of me, if I find myself in the proximity of it and it is, you know, in my vicinity, I can't deal with it, you know? And so I, if nothing else, I'm thankful. So, you know, maybe that's as far as we get in this life, you know what I mean? But in the meantime, I think you can definitely have several, you know, if, or, you know, maybe only, it's each individual's life, right? But this falling in love again thing is a definite blessed place to get to in life. Okay, so we are on this album now. Oh my goodness, it's a double album, people. Let's go. And like I said, I want to give you this album the way that I experienced it. It was just an album on the shelf, dude. And it was, it felt so cool. Had this, if you scratched it, it made it cool. You know what I mean? It was just the presentation, just from its presentation, it was a very desirable experience. And then definitely though, the first song, and I, like I said, I think I started, I had to just kind of start it on that second album, and the first song on that second album that I had to be absorbed, I became very excited to just learn all of this album. And so we're not going to talk about reviews, and we're not going to talk about sales. We're going to talk about what this was for Marvin. So here we go. Alrighty. Bye-bye.
Well, friends, that's it for this episode. Did we have fun? I had fun. Subscribe to our show so you never miss the enduring gifts of Marvin Gaye. Follow us on Pinterest, pinterest.com/MarvinGaye_enduring_gifts. There, we are up to 45,000 views per month. I have thousands of images and videos of Marvin. Also, check out the YouTube channel, Marvin Gaye's Enduring Gifts. I'm building the Song of the Day playlist there. It's my ultimate goal to become your free online Marvin Gaye listening resource. So, as always, we really appreciate your listening support. Give us subscribes, give us likes, and thank you for listening.